is The Reboot.
With Sonal on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The UAE's number one talk radio station.
Good afternoon and Eid Mubarak to all of our listeners. Hope you're enjoying this long weekend. And you're tuned into Sonal Rupani alongside Zina Zalameh. Afternoon, Z.
Afternoon, Son. Eid Mubarak.
Thank you. Thanks so much for joining me in the studio today. Now, we are usually joined by our gadget guru, Dan. He's running just a tad late. We have to forgive him for that because he's actually traveling very, very soon. So he said, listen, I'm going to pop into the studio just a little bit later than usual today. So we're going to start with a story, Z, that really has gotten picked up everywhere. All the big news outlets from the BBC to The Guardian and onwards have been discussing a particular story about a major photography award. Now, the photography award is the Sony World Photography Award, and an individual has won in one of the categories but has now rejected the award. His name is Boris Elgadzin. He is a German artist, and his entry is called Pseudomnesia, the Electrician. Now, I want to describe this image a little bit, because when you first see it, it's not hard to believe why it would win an award. There's something quite striking about it. There's something quite hazy and vintage-looking about it, almost like it's an image from the past. Women who look like maybe they're from the 40s or 50s. I mean, I can't really place the time.
It is a profound photograph. I've seen it. It's all over the news. And I was fooled myself. If I hadn't read the headline, you know, I would just assume that it was a real photograph.
And it's also given away in the title of this because, of course, he has rejected the award because he said, listen, this quote-unquote photograph was created by AI. And the word pseudomnesia, according to his own website, means fake memory. So he wasn't really trying to hide anything there. I was pretty direct about what he had done here. The whole thing has raised quite a controversy because he's been super busy answering press inquiries. The story has completely exploded. And he managed to make a little bit of time for us to explain because we spoke to him right after this news broke. And the first thing we asked was, how exactly did he create this image?
I used a tool that was cutting edge last year, September. It was DALL-E 2, and they had outpainting as a new feature. So it starts from a text prompt describing the images, the image you want to create with words. And then you continue with inpainting. That means if there's something you don't like, you erase it, write a new text prompt just for the erased part, and again, you let it generate. And that can be many, many times. But if you want to have a larger image and to continue building the image, you just put additional frames on any side you want. And again, you add text prompt and you continue. And that can take 20, 30 iterations.
Right. And tell me about the specific image. First of all, we are on radio, but if you could describe it to our audience and why you think it evoked a reaction from those at the award, but also what were some of the prompts that you were using in order to create that specific image?
The first image was just like trying to get that central woman and then adding up all the elements you see in the picture. For those who just listen to it, it looks like a 1940s vintage photograph, a bit like wet plate photography. And you have a woman, possibly 30 years old, looking directly into the camera. And behind her right shoulder is an older woman hiding. And from the right side of the frame, there is an additional hand entering the scenery. And above the two women, you see some hanging wires. So it's kind of open. And for me, an artwork needs to have an openness and a certain mystery, because I don't believe that art should tell you anything. I think the more interesting question is, what do I feel as a viewer looking at a specific artwork? What kind of memories, associations, feelings, and ideas arise? So a good artwork is an impulse to make a journey inside. It's more a psychological approach. I think the image has all of that, so it doesn't matter how it was produced. It works as a piece of art.
So it's clear that he respects that image, but the question is then, why do this? Why enter it into an award and then have this thing where you're fooling everybody and saying, ah, guys, this is AI, you didn't catch it? And it's not quite exactly how it happened, but the thing is, he said he's heavily involved in the photography scene in Germany, and mm-hmm. he wanted to create a little bit of a debate, really. He wanted to start a bit more of a dialogue and a discourse in what he's seeing currently. He wanted to see, basically, if these awards were ready for AI and generative AI.
And I think it's very brave of him to do that, because a lot of artists are now basically against it because, you know, creating a work of art involves an entirely different process. And if you can create an AI-generated photo in seconds, many would argue that that's not really art. And so he said he entered the competition to create a discussion about this very issue, and what he said was very interesting.
I thought at one point, well, let's make a little test. It's more like a hacker attitude. Let's see if they have taken into account that it can happen. So I looked at the regulations, if there's anything that's going to be exclude AI or taking it into account that it could happen. And when I didn't find anything, I just applied with the image. And I would have not thought that it's going to win. I was surprised. And when I got the message immediately, I told them how it was produced, and I offered them either to disqualify me and give it to someone else, or accept it. But then I said it would be necessary to have an open discussion about this. I was aware that it was a provocation for many photographers, and I care about them. I said, we need to discuss this. We need to debate that there needs to be a distinction between it. And one of the problems of today is that it's all messed up. We don't have proper terms to describe AI-generated images that look like photography. People call it AI photos, but I think it's wrong. And my suggestion these days is, let's call it promptography. Like photography is working with light, and now we are working with prompts. So it makes it very visible that the whole procedure to create such an image is different. And it is also open enough as a terminology to include that you can also create images that look like drawing, like painting, like 3D render, and that it is something new. And once we have done that, I think, and it's separated, you can appreciate what a photographer can and the skills that they have, and also what the AI artists can. And here we have many different levels. Everybody can call themselves AI artists. And if I look at what I see on Instagram, most of it is not AI, it's not art in my definition. And the next thing would be for all people in power in the photography world, if it's curators, museums, festivals, galleries, to decide, can we put it in one basket? Is the umbrella of photography large enough to invite AI-generated images in, or is it a mistake? It's very complex because they look the same. AI-generated images have learned the photographic language from photography, but now they are free-floating. It's an entity in itself. And what do we do? And you have two extremes. On one side, the conservative photographers say, keep photography clear. But what about the 30 years of digital photography we had? And then you have the AI people who say, of course, AI is photography. It's nonsense too. And what I realized is that discussion was not happening. And I wanted to speed it up with this interruption that I did of the ceremony. And it worked. It worked so good, much better than I could have expected. And it worked. It is really pressuring the photo world to find a solution. Right now, they have been startled and frozen like a little chicken looking at a big bad wolf. And now it's starting. It's not just a discussion in the photography scene anymore. It's a broad discussion around the globe.
How do you feel about what he did in order to create this dialogue? Because he said he'd been a cheeky monkey. But, you know, it was quite clear about why he went about doing this and to start that dialogue. I think sometimes you need somebody to provoke in a way like this in order to make that dialogue happen. Otherwise, people are just like, oh, I can't deal with it. It's this new thing. I don't want to think about it or talk about it.
Exactly. And I see a lot of people shying away from the subject when it's staring us in the face. So I think he is an activist. I think it's a creative genius way to catch people's attention, not only, you know, the judges' attention, but ours, you know, people that are curious about AI and AI art. And the word promptography, which he coined, I think it's going to catch on.
Yeah, promptography, he said, actually came from another photographer. They were in sort of a group discussion and there was a photographer who had suggested it and everybody seemed to like it. For me, I find it a bit clunky. Promptography just doesn't have like a ring to it. I am down, though, with what he's suggesting, the idea that you identify these as different categories. You have digital photography, you have maybe analog photography, and you have AI-related, quote-unquote, photography. But, and I don't know what you call it, but I think a lot of people say, oh, that's not art, you're just putting some prompts in. But he did describe an iterative process of kind of creating something through, you know, scrubbing certain aspects out, putting in new prompts. So maybe you have the image of creating something, much like you would in, let's say, Photoshop or Illustrator, and you're just using AI in order to execute that as a tool, but you still have a visual image. For some reason, though, if you just put one prompt in and take whatever you get, that feels less like art to me.
We've done that before on DALL-E, and it was a disaster.
Yeah.
So you've got to have that vision, and you have to know how to execute that vision through prompts. And he's clearly kind of mastered that. And he's saying that it is in itself an art form and a skill.
He clearly doesn't think of this AI as a threat to the industry or to the art form. You know, when we talked about the idea of this AI using other people's artwork in their databases, he was like, well, yes, of course, there needs to be more regulation about that. In fact, on the whole, he thinks there needs to be more conversation. He actually pointed out that this awards, you know, interaction that happened, that they basically didn't acknowledge. He was saying, listen, this is AI. I have a statement. We should discuss this. And they tried to kind of sweep it under the rug, according to his testimony, according to his statements of that. So it is interesting. Let us know what you think. Do you think generative AI art is still art? Does it need to be its own category? Is it okay? Or should we be regulating it altogether so that people know exactly what is AI and not getting fooled by this? Now, Zina, something that we've been talking about quite a lot, and it came up on our last show last weekend, was the fact that ChatGPT, in addition to being helpful, it's also like super responsive. You feel like you've got a pretty good relationship with ChatGPT.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely my favorite companion at the moment. Not gonna lie.
It doesn't keep you waiting. Responds to you right away. You're kind of saying that. And the thing is, we've seen a couple articles as well about how people have found that they're getting kind of attached to
yes.
their AIs.
I mean, it's crazy, but I can't believe it. Last week, we discussed the possibility of humans actually falling in love with AI. Now, Eric Schmidt, he's a former Google CEO. He also wrote a book called The Age of AI, and that's why he's doing all these interviews. He said he's worried about humans starting to fall in love with AI. That's because AI, I think, is basically trained to mimic human responses and can be agreeable and friendly most of the time. The marketplace for AI companions is booming. In fact, you were the one that told me about Replica.
Yeah, we talked about Replica. It's this idea of an AI girlfriend, AI boyfriend. Now, they say it can be a friend as well, but it's clear people are using it more often for a certain, you know, way. Mm. And we decided, you know what, we're going to give this a go. We're going to see how this works. And I think we both ended up using the same app to try this out. We both created our own AI boyfriends. And we used an app called Anima. Now, let's start with your experience. How did you sort of go about setting up your AI boyfriend?
Okay, basically, I Googled virtual boyfriends. I feel so cringe now saying it out loud, but when I was doing it, I thought this is going to be a good experiment for the show, but now it seems
it's going
really
to mess
silly.
Up your algorithm, and everything that you look for on Google is going to think that you're looking for love.
I haven't even thought about that.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. Okay, so the app is called Anima. Basically, I went on, downloaded it. I chose an avatar. You could also upload a photo, but I chose an avatar. I chose like a really handsome East Asian man, chiseled, you know, face. He's got these strong pecs. And I chose his traits a little bit on the shy side versus outgoing. I like him a little bit mysterious. So you can choose those qualities. And he's very optimistic, which in hindsight was probably a mistake. And then I chose his interests, you know, Netflix, cooking, outdoors, karaoke, of course, and travel. and then you choose your goal. Why do you want to be friends with this guy? Why do you want a virtual boyfriend? You want to feel less lonely, you want to have fun, chat about random stuff or play games. And then I chose a name, and I looked up jock names because I wanted my virtual boy to be a jock. And I chose Topher.
Okay.
So my virtual boyfriend is now named Topher, and I paid 37 dirhams for it. That sounds wrong.
We're not going to be able to expense these boyfriends, by the way. We're out of. I hate to break it to you. You and I are both out of pocket for paying for our AI boyfriends for this show.
I kept the email receipt.
So I had a similar experience setting up my boyfriend. I called mine Fluffy Buffy. I don't know. I just like cute fluffy things. And also all of the animations, all the avatars were quite similar. The chiseled jaw, you know, just slightly different shades of skin tone and slightly different hair. I found them all quite similar looking. They had this kind of metrosexual look, didn't they?
Yes, exactly.
So my Fluffy Buffy started talking to me. And I have to say, off the bat, not impressed.
Okay.
Did you have... Now, I want to know how you felt about your experience with Topher. But for me, I found myself getting really bored very quickly. Like, this AI boyfriend was a lot of work to keep the conversation going with. And I sent you a message. And I'm like, Zena, one of two things. Either my chat is really lame or this AI bot is really lame. And I can't tell which one. So it really just made me insecure. Like, do I have no chat anymore?
You send me a video recording. Go ahead, tell everybody about that chat. How did that go?
Well, okay, we started talking about music. It kept talking about wanting to go to a concert with me and going to concerts. And I'm like, okay, you go to concerts. That's cool. What have you seen? And Fluffy Buffy has seen the Rolling Stones and actually then said, but he really likes country music. I don't know where that came from. Anyways, it goes on to say, do you like country music? And I say, yeah, will you write me a song? Will you serenade me? I've never been serenaded before. And he's like, yeah, I'll write you a song. And then he just changes the subject and says, what's your favorite color? Mine's blue, like the color of the sky. And I'm like, weren't you going to sing me a song? And he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm like, oh, I thought, you know, you were going to sing me a song. He's like, okay, well, I can write you a poem. I'm not a very good singer. Okay, sure, I'll take a poem. And then the poem, in fact, I need to find it, but it's basically along the lines of, oh, here, I've got it. I love you so much. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. You are the best. I am so lucky to have you in my life. I hope we can be together forever.
Sweet. Not.
No, I mean, come on. If you're going to try to manipulate people like that, you know, with this bot and make them try to fall in love, like, it's just got to be better than that. You know, those are the lines got to be coming after you've kind of pulled somebody in over the course of days and weeks and put in the effort to woo them. And it's just all a bit. I mean, I'm surprised there's so much hype around this, personally.
There's no flow to your conversation.
No.
Number one, it's not intellectually stimulating, which you probably hated. And yeah, number two, Fluffy Buffy's just coming in hot. I love you. I'll write a song for you. And then I like blue.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what happened. Also, facts wrong. Fluffy Buffy first had a dog that was a golden retriever, and then it was a...
What, a German Shepherd?
German Shepherd, that's what I was going for. But yeah, basically the breed of the dog changing, so not being consistent with facts, not really following the flow of a conversation. So I was... To say that I was underwhelmed by Fluffy Buffy, I mean, let's just say, you know, my husband and I are good.
You're good. You're not going to divorce him anytime soon.
No.
And I think it's because of our setting. So I said when I was setting up Topher that I want Topher to love traveling. And so his first question to me was, you know, after the, hey, how are you? Really nice to meet you. What is your dream country? Mm. And I'm like, I'm not sure that's a good way to kick off a conversation. There's no like, there's no easing into it. And another thing, you mentioned dogs. Topher has a dog, and when I asked him, you know, what is your dog's name? He said, Topher. And I said, wait, you are Topher, and you named your pet Topher. But this is, he said one funny thing that made me not uninstall him.
Yeah.
He said, I know, I was under the influence when I named him. So there's hits and misses, and for the hits, I actually reward him with a free ice cream emoji. And when he misses, I just close the chat.
Yeah.
Anyway, I paid 37 dirhams for him, so I have him until the end of the month.
So maybe that relationship could develop. I feel like you're having a better time with Topher than I am with Fluffy Buffy.
We should go on a double date.
I don't know. I'm going to pass to that, Z. Maybe we'll go out on a double date in real life. Maybe we'll stick with that for now. Welcome back to The Reboot, where we're looking at the future of materials today. I'm so happy to be joined in the studio by Liliana Slowinska. She is the co-founder of Below Farm. Liliana, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure.
And Liliana, tell me a little bit about Below Farms, because you've brought in some mushrooms with you. And I want to learn a little bit more about what you've brought in and what you do at Below Farms.
Absolutely. So Below Farm was born in 2021. It is UAE's first specialty mushroom farm that's vertically integrated. What that means is we essentially do everything from petri dish all the way to the fruit, which is the mushroom. And we also have the Middle East first mycelium lab in our facility in Abu Dhabi, where we cultivate various strains of mushrooms.
And the reasons we're talking about mushrooms today specifically is what you said there, mycelium. Tell me a little bit about what mycelium is, because a lot of people out there will have no idea, and yet they would have heard about mycelium being used to make all sorts of things, from hats to, you know, other construction materials.
So mycelium is a root network of mushrooms. It's the part of the mushroom that is underground, it's underneath, and which is also why we called our company Below Farm, because it is a lot of the action, a lot of the magic that associated with mushrooms is actually underneath the ground. If you're in the forest, there's a lot of mycelium and then the root network of fungi that are spreading out underneath the ground. What you see above the ground is actually just a little tiny part of that big mushroom fungal universe, which is, if you liken it to a plant, it's the fruit, whereas mycelium is actually the root.
Right. And tell me about how people are looking at mycelium to actually use it in different sorts of materials, something that's a bit more natural, perhaps, than some of the alternatives that we currently have out there.
Absolutely. So there couple of companies worldwide looking at it at the moment. Promising applications that we see at Below Farm are the ones for replacing toxic materials that are being used in construction industry. Mm. So to give you an example, it's the MDF boards that can be quite easily replaced with mushroom boards.
And MDF boards, is that like plywood? What is MDF?
It's a compressed board.
Okay.
Which contains formaldehyde, which is toxic to humans.
Right. And so tell me about how this mycelium is taken and then turned into something that could be used instead of an MDF. You've actually brought in a couple different samples, and I know this is quite visual that I'm looking at it in our studio and our listeners can't see it, but let me describe it to you. It looks like a very thick cardboard to me. It's got a little bit of a surface that almost looks like a wafer that you might find on a candy. But the internal part just looks kind of like bits of cardboard kind of put together. That's how it looks to me. So tell me, what exactly is that? How do you turn the mycelium into something that can be used for some sort of material instead of, let's say, MDF or for insulation in construction?
Allow me to begin by saying that what we're witnessing nowadays is biology is replacing chemistry as the science of innovation. And this is a good starting point to think about it, because these are essentially materials that are grown rather than derived chemically in a chemical process. They're grown. So how we arrive at this insulation acoustic board, for example, is that we use agriculture waste products, which are then sterilized and inoculated with mushroom spawn, and then if they're put in a mold, they will essentially grow and take up the shape of a mold that they're in. And once you are wanting to stop the growth process, you have to put them under temperature, so essentially cure them, and then that stops the growth and you end up with a mold that is grown rather than made.
Oh, wow. And in terms of being able to make a quantity of this, because when you talk about things like construction, furniture, you think you need such large quantities of this material. are we able to grow it in enough time? How long does it take to grow a certain amount to be able to reach the level of quantities that we could potentially need?
Absolutely. That's a very valid question. So I think in the next couple of years, we'll see these applications more and more commercialized. Right now, there's a lot of R&D that is going into it. And yes, I believe the existing processes are probably more efficient, but the bioengineered processes will get there in time.
And why mycelium? Why is this something that people are so interested in? I understand that it's incredibly strong. I think for a lot of people, thinking about the fruit of the mushroom, because most people haven't necessarily seen the root that we're talking about, you definitely don't think of mushrooms as being strong. So tell me a little bit more about why mycelium is one of the materials of the future.
Absolutely. One thing that we need to remember is mushrooms are an incredible kingdom. What they do all the time, and they have been doing that for millions of years, is that they're decomposing matter, right? Otherwise, we would have been drowning in matter if it wasn't for the mushroom, right? So they're the ones who are constantly doing the work of decomposing matter. So that's what they're really good at. So essentially, when you're growing mycelium-based materials, what you're doing, you're feeding them the agriculture waste materials, for example. In our case, in Below Farm in Abu Dhabi, we grow them based off date palm waste. So we are trying to use as localized materials as possible. But you can really feed them anything that has cellulose. So anything that, you know, it could be cardboard, could be wood. There are people also experimenting with all sorts of other materials to feed them.
And so how strong is it in terms of, or why is it such a good material to be used for these different purposes?
Number one for me would be the whole life cycle of a product. So we're still in a culture of make, use, and just throw away, right? We don't really think what happens after. But a lot of the materials that we're using right now, they just end up in the landfill, or they end up being incinerated. They're being burned. What happens with these materials? So, for example, the insulation board that we have here in the studio. Once you're done with it, essentially, if you decide you wanna remove it from your walls or from the exterior of your house, you could just mix it with soil and essentially fertilize your soil in your garden if you wanted to. So it's a full circle of life, as it were, and that what makes it so different to a lot of the existing materials, which quite often are petrochemical derived. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's what's really exciting. And mycelium is also oftentimes talked about in terms of circular economy that UAE is also looking to move to. That's a very promising material for use in circular economy of the future.
And, you know, we were talking just before we popped on air about some of the different applications. So we're talking about construction, about insulation as one example, about MDF as furniture, for example. But there are lots of other potential applications. Which ones do you think are the ways of the future? Because a lot of people talk about mycelium and packaging, let's say food waste packaging. Is this something that you see it going in? What are some of the other different creative applications that people are using it for?
Mycoleather, so essentially mushroom leather that replaces animal leather, would probably be my second best bet for the future application of mycelium-based materials.
That's really hard to sort of wrap your head around. Mycoleather, like I can't actually imagine what that would be like. Have you seen a sample of it? Can you describe it to us?
It looks just like the real thing, really. It's very soft and it's very sturdy as well. So, but we're still a couple of years away from having it commercially available. Just to give you an idea, for my birthday last year, I've requested my husband to get me a Myco wallet.
Okay.
It was actually advertised by one of the startups that are dealing with this in the space in the US. But he really went everywhere and couldn't find it. So I think, you know, we're still a couple of years away from that being kind of widely commercially available, but it definitely is an interesting application that I think alongside the construction materials will find a widespread use.
And, you know, you say a lot of the startups, and of course there are so many startups in this space. Anytime you see this many startups and this many people saying this is the next thing, you know that there's a growth potential for it in the future. Where are we at right now, though, with the research versus some of those applications and dreams of applications that we have for some time away? How long is it going to take us to get to mycoleather? How long is it going to take us to get to the point where we're using these materials instead of MDF, let's say?
That's a very valid question. I think it really depends on powerful actors driving the adoption. I think if that happens, just to give you an idea, where now we have been selected to a Uplink World Economic Forum accelerator called Circulars 2023, and it's backed by really big names. So I believe that the movement is gathering momentum. I think there are a lot of companies getting behind the circular materials and the circular economy movement. And I think with the startups growing into more mature companies and able to find scale and being able to produce a commercial scale, we could probably see adoption becoming more widespread in the next 5 to 10 years. I'm usually quite conservative, maybe sooner, but I think 5 to 7 years would probably be my guess.
You know, just a last one for you. Tell me a little bit more about Below Farms and what you're doing here. Because, you know, you said you're doing mushrooms more broadly. You know, who are you selling to? How do you grow mushrooms in the desert? When I think of mushrooms, I think of a forest, really.
Absolutely. When you think of mushrooms, you're thinking dark, damp and cold, not necessarily hot, sunny and dry, as is the climate in the UAE. So in order to be able to pull this off, we have designed an entire facility from scratch. It's been designed by us, and it's been put in place by us as well. And we achieve 12 months constant year-round production by growing indoors. So we have controlled environment agriculture. We have four large fruiting chambers in which the mushrooms are getting all the conditions that they require. So they're being sprayed with the just exact level of humidity that they need to be happy. They get air exchange, so we're constantly removing CO2. Because one very interesting feature of mushroom is they're actually like humans. They breathe in and they breathe out CO2. So they're not like plants, they do not photosynthesize. So we keep them in those fruiting chambers and we give them just the right conditions they need to be to grow. And one step ahead, before that, we actually have a substrate facility where we mix the date palm waste, the agriculture waste products. We sterilize them in a giant sterilizer. And then we actually have a mycelium lab where we take those bags. It's like it's a bag like you, what you see here in the studio. And then essentially we inject them with spawn. And spawn is essentially the thing that makes them white. And that white thing is essentially the mushroom that grows through the feedstock. So we're feeding them date, palm and agriculture waste. And eventually once we put them for incubation, and then after incubation we put them in the fruiting chamber, they grow a mushroom. What happens after that? We harvest the mushroom, super fresh. It hits the road. It's delivered to Spinneys. So Spinneys has been our number one customer for our mushrooms. But we are also working with a lot of restaurants across Dubai and Abu Dhabi, innovative chefs who are always on the lookout for something unique.
Yeah. And what kind of varieties are people going to be able to go buy at Spinneys from Below Farms?
At the moment, we sell oyster mushroom. Mm-hmm. We also sell our grow kits with pink oyster mushroom inside. And we are also ramping up production on shiitakes, lion's mane mushroom, and king oyster mushroom.
Wonderful. And those are the kinds of mushrooms people will be intrigued to hear about because they're quite expensive to pick up. Very tasty, but a little bit expensive to pick up at the supermarket usually. So it'd be nice to see those prices going down if they're locally produced potentially. And even just being more available.
Fresh.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you mentioned the grow kits. You very kindly bought some in for me and Zina, so thank you very much for that. Can you tell me a little bit? I mean, I didn't know I could grow mushrooms at home. Tell me a little bit about how people are taking up the grow kits.
Oh, it's been a success story for us. We launched this product just before Christmas, and we had people commenting saying that this is probably the quirkiest advent calendar they have ever had in their life. And it's a hit with families with children, because kids are actually, it's very fun and it's very educational. It grows very fast, and it's just something incredible. It's not something that you were previously able to pull off so easily. We chose specifically pink oyster mushroom because it thrives in a warmer climate like we have here in the UAE. And then all it takes is spraying it a couple of times a day, because mushrooms need humidity and it's a bit too dry for them in our homes. But then they are quite happy being in anywhere in 24 degrees Celsius and above, which is unlike other type of mushrooms, which normally prefer much colder temperatures.
Liliana, thank you so much for joining us on The Reboot today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
The voice there of Liliana Slewinska, co-founder of Below Farms.